Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf is with us here on Sports Byline, former point guard who during his nine-year NBA career with Denver, Sacramento, and Vancouver, and is considered one of the greatest free-throw shooters in the history of the game. He missed the all-time free-throw shooting NBA season record by only a single miss, and also he was an outstanding three-point shooter. Mahmoud, let's go back to where it all began, Gulfport, Mississippi. Describe that town to me. What was it like?
Oh, it's a small town, about four or five blocks from the Gulf of Mexico. You know, grew up in a fairly tough neighborhood. But the people are pretty much relatively nice people. Of course, you know, growing up in the ghetto, you have your problems like in most ghettos throughout America. But by and large, I had a lot of you have your naysayers, of course, people that try to discourage you. But I had a lot of people also that was on my side that was wishing me well, where my roots are.
You know, it was really difficult for you because it was poverty. I mean, there were times that you and your brothers were not able to have proper nutrition. You missed the fourth grade, and later on you were placed in a special education classes. Those were all things that could be really challenging to a young person. How did you work your way through that?
You know, I was just fortunate and true. You're absolutely correct. I was fortunate to be in a family, not so much my mother, but my grandmother, my uncles, and my aunts. And we were taught, you know, I know we're living in an age right now where it's kind of taboo to speak about God. But, you know, I was just brought up in that type of environment that God is the most powerful and that having the belief in Him, anything is possible. And it's just not enough to pray about something, but move toward what you're praying for. And so those are the type of things that I held close to me, just that belief and the gifts that He has given me and that anything is possible. And that helped to push me through.
Yeah, you overcame an awful lot. And how did basketball factor into that? What type of discipline did that bring to your life and help you along?
Oh, my basket, you know, just sports in general, but basketball was kind of like, I've said this in the past, I grew up without a father. And so sometimes as a child, you miss not having that. And basketball was kind of like that father in some crazy way that I didn't have. So I really spent so much time on the basketball court where I didn't really have to think about so much not having. And it just helped me to become, you know, it toughened me up, you know, mentally strong, physically strong, because for me, basketball wasn't just, I love the sport. It wasn't always fun, but for me, it was more about, you know what, I believe this is something that I can accomplish and get my mother out the ghetto and do some great things with. And it became an issue of life and death with me. And so I put everything I had into it, not settling for a B or C option, looking at, look, this is the only option I have, and I got to make it. If I don't, I don't know what's going to happen to me.
One of the things you said, and here's the quote, I was just fortunate to come across good people that kept me on the right track, kept me busy, and not distracted, which happens to so many youth today. Really, I think that's why I'm here. Not so much about me, but mentioning a lot of people contributing to success. I don't think success is in a vacuum. It's something that is isolated. Your environment, the people you come in contact with, everybody plays a part in making you who you are. Who was it that helped most prominently in making you who you were?
Well, you know, certainly my mother. Just seeing her get up every day and struggle and sacrifice. You know, she gets the main award. But just there were so many people. There's a guy named Pop that used to always sit and talk to me. There's a guy that I wish I could remember his name today, because when I was young, I developed a little arrogant attitude because I was just blessed with natural abilities, and he cursed me out so bad. and at that moment, and it wasn't me to do that. I was following the crowd. And once he did that, I decided at that moment, I said, from this day forward, I'm going to carry myself in a humble way and let my actions speak for me. And once I did that, doors just began to open that never opened before because of my character. And just going out and just playing the game and just trying to be the best I can be. And I wish I knew him to this day. Even when I talk about it today, man, my eyes water up, but I just can't remember who he was. I would literally find this person and thank him with everything that's in me for just you know, coming at me like that when I was a young man.
Another person that was certainly instrumental in your life was Gulfport High School basketball coach Bert Jenkins, because you have said the best coach of any coach you experienced, and that includes college and NBA coaches.
No question. He was a disciplinarian. I mean, he focused on the fundamentals. He didn't believe in wasted movement, anything unnecessary. Everything had to count. Just an extraordinary gentleman, person, him and his wife as well. They were the first ones that actually, outside of my mother, that really made an effort in getting me diagnosed, because it's through Lil Jenkins and Coach Jenkins that I was able to go to a doctor named Dr. Jackson in Gulfport. And in 11th grade, they diagnosed me with having Tourette syndrome. Up until that point, I didn't know what it was that I was dealing with.
You were named Mississippi Mr. Basketball twice. How did you end up then with Dale Brown at LSU?
You know, just being recruited and all that comes with that, and people promising you a whole bunch of stuff. Well, you come with us, you're going to play. I just always felt that was, you know, how do you know that? How do you know that somebody else is not going to come in and work hard that summer and outplay me? How can you promise me something that you have no idea of what's going to happen in the future? But LSU, you know, Dale Brown in particular, Coach Cars, who was heavily recruited me, we talked maybe 1,000 hours, and 99% of those talks had nothing to do with basketball. And so I really felt that they had my best interest, and they never promised me that I was going to play. They said, look, if you come and you have what it takes to, you know, be productive and get the minutes, you'll play. And that's all I wanted. I just wanted a fair shot. I didn't want any unnecessary favoritism. Just give me a fair shot. And that's what drove me to go to LSU.
You know, it can be very mind-bending. Think about it for just a second. Any 18-year-old kid, athlete with talent, and everybody's whispering in his ear, friends, family, coaches, everybody trying to recruit him and everything. I don't know how they get through that. How hard was it for you?
How they get through?
In other words, all the people whispering in their ear and telling them this and that, you know, about them, that they're great and all of those things. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, it's tough. I mean, it's tough not to fall a victim or prey to that. You know, you start believing the stories. And I've always been fortunate. A rule that I tell myself all the time, no matter how great the game was, I tell myself to never be satisfied. And there's always room for improvement. Yes, be grateful, but never be satisfied, because having that mentality always keeps me hungry and it keeps me humble. So when I'm hearing all of that, I listen, and I verbally say, oh, thank you very much. And I mean it, but the other part of me is saying never be satisfied. There's always room for improvement, to keep a balance, because, you know, this is, and not everybody's doing that. They believe in the stories, and before you know it, they stop working. You see this happening a lot. And, you know, that's it.
In your third game at LSU, you set the record for scoring for a freshman. You really got off to the quick start. You scored 48 points against Louisiana Tech and then 53 points against Florida as well. You scored 55 points against Ole Miss to break your own record. Did that surprise you? I mean, that's not just good numbers. That's great numbers.
Oh, man, look, I still, when I talk about that to this day, I'm still amazed at how in the world did they allow me to make that many points. You know what I mean? I mean, no, seriously, because I literally thought something was going to happen to me. It was all happening too fast. After the second game, Dale Brown, after having 21, he said, we need you to score more. I said, Coach, I'll try. And that's when the 48 came, the 53 came. But the thing that I talk about a lot, too, in reference to that, when I look back on it, I say, man, from elementary all the way up to now, I've been doing the same moves, trying to become more explosive, quicker, faster, more consistent. And that goes to show that consistency and belief goes a long way. I thought that I would have to change something, so, you know, change my game so much. But I was doing the same stuff, but it was just at a higher level. But definitely surprised, even to this day.
We've got about 30 seconds left. You were a two-time SEC Player of the Year, two-time All-American, and you decided to leave college basketball and move on to the NBA. I want to talk about that when we come back on the other side, because to me, that's always a tough decision. But just in about 15 seconds, just tell me what was the first thought that came into your mind when you were thinking about maybe jumping to the NBA?
Getting my mother out of poverty. That was the main decision, the main reason why. I went home and I put my hand, I was washing my hands. The sink fell in. I went into the refrigerator. It was empty. And I'm thinking about myself at LSU having all of these three meals a day. And I said, I just can't stay. Because, I mean, tomorrow's not guaranteed. I got to go.
Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf is with us, and we're talking about his outstanding basketball career, not only in college at LSU, but, of course, he went on and had great success in the NBA as well. We continue across the country and around the world. Good to have you with us here on America's sports talk show, Sports Byline. Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf is with us. Of course, you know, he was a two-time SEC Player of the Year, two-time All-American, played 9 years in the NBA with Denver, Sacramento, and Vancouver. Mahmoud, what did you think pro basketball was going to be like, and how was it similar to or different from what you thought?
I thought that it was going to definitely be challenging and on a higher level of play because, like, when you go to college, mostly every college player that you see was the man on their high school team. When you go to the NBA, mostly every person in the NBA was the man on their college team. And then it's just a little bit more better, you know, a pick, so to speak. So I definitely thought it would be challenging, more physical. The guys were going to be more explosive and faster, things of that nature. So I wasn't surprised. In a sense, it pretty much was what I thought in that area.
Two things that I think about, and one, I've had my friends in the NBA tell me that when stars come out of college and into the NBA, they forget sometimes that you have to reprove yourself at the next level. And the other thing, that if you happen to be a player in your senior year in college and you're going up against a sophomore or maybe even a junior, you can dominate usually. But when it comes to the NBA, if you're a rookie, a second-year player, third-year player, you may be going up against somebody that's been in this league for 10 years and knows how the game's played at that level. Tell me a little bit about what you saw. Was that a difficult transition for you, or how did you approach it? Because you were the third overall pick in that draft.
Yeah, well, the thing that messed me up more than anything, I was listening to people telling me, well, you have to be bulky, you have to be bigger and stronger, and not thinking about, well, you know, I'm just leaving college, and a lot of these guys are going to the NBA, and these guys that I'm playing against are strong, too. And so I began to gain weight, and I did it all the wrong way. So I came in out of shape. I was miserable. I began to get depressed. And you're right. People sometimes lose sight of the fact that you not just every year or every league, but literally every day you have to reprove yourself. Because every day in practice, someone is trying to dominate you. You can't take a rest. Because if they get more consistent in dominating you in practice, there's a chance the coach is going to put them in the game and give them a shot. So you can't take a rest. You can't get comfortable at all.
I know at one time you had said that you had kind of lost interest in basketball. Did that happen to you, or what was the circumstances there?
Yes, it happened to me, actually, my first year or so, because that reason, I was just so out of shape. And, you know, your mind is telling you to do things, but your body won't allow you to. And then just the setup, the first year, the coach and I, we didn't really – and I don't blame him, because I wasn't the player that I was when I came out of college. Again, I was out of shape. I wasn't really performing at a higher level. So we didn't see eye to eye. And so all of that, on top of that, it just kind of turned me off a little bit. But I was fortunate to read an article that just lighted a spark, because I was told, well, he's a bust. And I got angry because I didn't want to be considered a bust. So definitely I lost interest for a minute, but I was able to fortunately gain it back.
I'm just wondering, when you watch the NBA today and you see Steph Curry, because I got to tell you, when I watch Steph Curry, I think about you at times. Because you can hit the free throws, you hit the three-pointers, you're a great assist guy. Do you see yourself a little bit in somebody like a Steph Curry?
We definitely have similarities. I mean, he's prolific. It's a new game. It's more of seems geared towards guards and just shooters. They stretch threes and stretch fours. Everybody's shooting the ball. So I definitely see similarities. He has a quick release. He can definitely handle the rock. He can shoot the mid-range, the three-pointer. He has different angles when he shoots the ball. I definitely see similarities. But, I mean, I love his game. He's just, yeah, he's – I love to see skillful people, definitely.
I have a motto that you said that you live by, and I found it very engaging and very thoughtful. It's one that you developed during your early playing days. You say, we don't have the luxury to waste our time, to not leave a legacy worth leaving. Everybody is special, and everybody is capable of doing great things. This has become my motto. How did that develop?
Well, actually, I've had that belief for a while, but the actual quote came later. It was by George Washington Carver that no one has the right to come into this world and go out of it without leaving behind distinct and legitimate reasons for having passed through it. So, you know, we don't have the luxury to waste what we've been blessed to have by God, these gifts. So leave a legacy worth leaving. And so he just put it in a whole lot better words than I could have when I was younger. but it came from just an early age of, you know, my grandmother and my uncles and my aunts teaching me the value of, look, you've been given something, you know, by God, and you have a duty. You have a responsibility to maximize it to the best of your abilities. And so that's what I tried. Now, it didn't work in every aspect of my life, like education and things of that nature, but definitely because I love basketball and I saw a future in it, it definitely resonated in that area.
One of the things that I've always believed personally, that 2 and 2 is 4, but then so is 3 and 1, and so is 1 and 3. And so I bring that up as a prelude to the decision that you made to refuse to stand for the Star-Spangled Banner before games, stating that the flag was a symbol of oppression and the United States had a long history of tyranny. And yet you said in a speech that you gave, the decision was not meant in any way to be disrespectful to those who regard the national anthem as a sacred ceremony. I'm an African-American, a citizen of this country, and one who respects freedom of speech and freedom of expression. Tell me a little bit how you got to that particular point to make that decision to decide to do what you did. And also, what is it that people don't understand about what you were saying?
Wow, that's tough to minimize, but I'll try. It was just, I began to read more. Once I became a Muslim, I began to read more than I'd ever read before in my life. And I came across a lot of different authors, the Noam Chomsky's, the Gore Vidal's, the Randall Robinson's, and the Aaron Daddy Roy's. And I'm reading things that I never knew what was going on, not just domestically, but, you know, in foreign policy. And coming from the background that I came from, being miseducated, because I was miseducated, you know, my mother had an eighth-grade education, I began to find out things of, wow, why wasn't I taught this? Why didn't I learn this? And so I began to feel cheated in a way. And so these things just opened my eyes to a lot of things. And I grew up poor. I know what it feels like to be poor. And so when I'm hearing some of these things, it rubbed me the wrong way. And so I began to look at a symbol, and the symbol is supposed to represent, right, the character of a nation. And when I didn't feel that that was being necessarily represented, this is how I chose to respond. And it was never meant to be public, because for the longest, nobody ever knew. But someone caught wind of it. I spoke my conscience, and then it went global. But as I said before, it was initially meant to be a private protest. Not that it wouldn't have become public by me, but I was still searching, trying to find an understanding of how the world was working. And I remember seeing even veterans at times booing. And so I said, look, you don't understand. This is also for you. Because in so many ways, veterans, they go and we hear, well, they gave the ultimate sacrifice, right? But when they come back, some of them can't even get medical care. Some of them are homeless. This is not how you treat somebody who gave the ultimate sacrifice. You know, so I was just really trying to think broadly and look at those things that really rubbed me the wrong way. And that was my way of protesting and trying to bring attention to it, which I think we all in some ways should do, you know, according to, you know, our conscience. whatever that is, whether it's writing a politician, whether it's standing up for something, whether it's giving money to a cause. I think we all have a responsibility to stand up against what we consider to be unjust.
When you take a look at Colin Kaepernick and what he did and the way he demonstrated the way he felt as well, did you see something in that that maybe most people would probably miss?
No, I saw a person, after speaking to him, I saw a person who was doing the same thing. He was developing a conscience, and he that conscience that he had wouldn't allow him to rest comfortably. And so that was his way of trying to find comfort in his life and trying to do something that he thought would make a difference. And we all approach things differently. And after talking to him, he mentioned, and that's the same way that I felt and feel today. He said, you know, I've never felt more free than I feel right now. And this is what I saw in him.
It's interesting that he should say that to you, because there were death threats and a spray-painted KKK sign on a sign near your home that you were building in Mississippi, and you were traded at the end of that season. And you once said after that, your decision to speak your mind was relieving. And that was exactly what he had said to you, wasn't it?
Yes, of course. And that resonated with me right away. And I said, this is what it does when you do that. So for the longest, I would see things and I wouldn't feel the strength and the courage to speak about it. And it would bother me. Because I'm presenting myself as this confident, you know, courageous athlete that really knows himself, shaking hands, but deep down I'm a coward. You know, there's a lot going on. I'm insecure. And I'm like, no, I don't want to live that way, and I don't want to die that way. And so I had to do a lot of self-searching. You know, and I said, look, man, life is short. You know, and if this is something that means something to me, I have to start somewhere. I have to learn how to say no. I have to start speaking my conscience. Even if, look, I'm not going to have all the answers, right? But if it's something that I believe to be true, I have to move on it. And then we'll figure it out as we go. And so that was my process, and that's what I saw also in him. And it resonated right away when he said that.
Yeah, I've always been so respectful of you because you've been true to yourself. And I think everybody has to be that way. I don't know that they can, because there are things that come in that maybe – take over and are more important. But you said, I understand sometimes people view the flag as a sacred ceremony. People fought for this country under that banner. I understand that you've got to understand that I've got to deal with myself every day, the good and the bad. I just felt in my heart that if I can't do something, as a Muslim, we try to be perfect, whatever it is that we do. If I couldn't stand, if I couldn't do it 100%, I felt, don't do it at all. And I thought that was such a true, honest statement.
Yes. I can't say it any better. I don't have anything to say to that. I agree.
You know, basketball, is it fair to say you were a basketball junkie? Because, I mean, I took a look. You played outside the country so many times. You just wanted to keep playing the game you loved.
Yeah, you know what? It's in my DNA. I'm so competitive. I'm still trying at 48 years old. I told now my ex-wife, I said, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if I die training, I die playing, you know, because I'm still trying to get better. I'm still trying to find new ways to get my shot off. I mean, it's ridiculous. But so you might be right.
The other thing I think, too, is that when you find something that you love, you shouldn't give it up unless you absolutely have to. Is there a moment in your mind in your basketball career that really is engraved in your mind that you'll never, ever forget, Mahmoud?
You know, man, just growing up on the parks, and I had so many near-death experiences training because I wanted it so bad. Not just being afraid of failure, but just wanting to be great, wanting to be recognized and appreciated, wanting just to be the best. And those moments, I know those moments helped to shape and mold who I am today, to push me through, you know, the problems that, you know, everybody at some point we go through, and just to never give up. You know, and it, those are moments that that I would definitely treasure for the rest of my life, because I could have been that kid that gave up. And I think Tourette syndrome has something to do with that, because it pushed me beyond where I might wouldn't have gone without it. Because when I wanted to stop, it was like it came in and said, now you have to play mean. You have to do it this way, and you have to go full speed, even though you're tired, even though you're out of breath. And if you don't make them this way, I'm going to make your life miserable if you leave. And I couldn't leave until I had to finish that drill that way. If all of them had to go net, they had to go net 10 in a row. If I was on my 10th one at skim rim and went in, I had to start back at zero, even though it went in. And just fighting through that helped me to become the person I am today. So I will never forget those moments.
Let me switch gears. Basketball still a part of your life. I might let people know around the world that there's going to be a Big Three basketball league. It's the American 3-on-3 Professional Basketball League, founded by Ice Cube, and the entire league is operated and managed by the players. There are 8 teams of 5 players and a coach per team, and an 8-week regular season will move into Week 9 playoffs and then the Week 10 championship, and the inaugural season begins on Sunday this year. And regular season games will follow each Saturday for 10 weeks. I can tell you that Mahmood will be a part of this league. Tell me a little bit more about this league and what are people going to see?
Well, I'm not big on trash talking unless you piss me off. You know, I'll just say what I have to say and try to let my actions and God will do the rest. But there's supposed to be some trash talking. It's going back to the old school rules of hand checking. There's a 14-second shot clock, so it's not going to be old guys sitting around to post up, hold on, wait for a minute, you know, to catch their breath. There's going to be a four-point shot, three-point shot that you can't foul out. Any fouls after 6, even if the guy's not shooting, goes to the free throw line. That's why they have to have 5 people on as opposed to 3, because it's going to be constant. If you make the shot, you have to clear it out at half court so that the clock is ticking 14 seconds. So it's going to be high tempo. There's going to be a lot of substitution because we're going to have to get used to it as well. But I think if guys come in shape the way I believe they will, it's going to be entertaining. And I'm just looking forward to it. I'm just grateful that he established this league. I'm grateful to him. It gives us at least a last shot, if not a couple of more, to live that moment.
Yeah, I see some of the names in here. Pretty impressive names. Allen Iverson is one. Kwame Brown is another one. Chauncey Billups is another one. Clyde Drexler, the Hall of Famer. And even Dr. J is going to be coach of one of the teams as well. Rick Barry, the Hall of Famer as well. I think this is going to be a lot of fun. And also the fact that the Olympics in 2020 in Japan are going to be having 3-on-3 basketball as well. So I think this is something that is at the right time in the right way.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But I do. I believe it's going to be something that fans are going to be excited about, or at least I hope they are.
Well,
I think it's going to grow.
I think it is too. Well, I'm going to look forward to seeing you, and I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. I want to thank you very much for being a part of Sports Byline. You're welcome here anytime.
Thank you so much.
Mahmood Abdul-Rauf with us on America's Sports Talk Show.